now back to our discussion with Jeff Gollop, who came around to my house. Welcome, listeners. This is the Friday Politics Show with me, Billy Quain, on Bristol Community 93.2 FM across the city of Bristol and worldwide on bcfmradio.com. Welcome back. If you would like to contact me this evening, and I would encourage you to do so, 60777 is the text message number. Start your message with BCFM. It will come straight through to me in the studio. You can send me an email, studio@bcfmradio.com, and we do exist on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, all that sort of stuff, if you'd like to contact us that way. Frankly, I don't really know how to use the social media deliberately, because I inherently disagree with big data or being participant and available on big data, but turns out radio stations don't seem to have the same concerns. In discussion this evening, we've been having a good old chat, a ding dong, with Jeff Gollop, who is the Conservative member for Westbury on Trim and Henlees. We've covered quite a lot of ground so far, Martin. What would you like me to ask Jeff next?
Well, I think that doesn't always make much difference, because obviously whatever you asked him is what you've asked him. So I don't know. Let's find out. Well, what did you ask him?
Let's indeed. No, one of the things that's been grinding my gears for a long time, since there has been an elected mayor in Bristol, is a lack of transparency. And there's some big salaries being paid to management for no evident reason. So, you know, I thought I would ask Jeff Gollop, being a man with a financial background, whether it made any sense to him, because neither you nor I are in the council chamber, and we're certainly not empowered to talk in the council chamber. He is in the council cabinet, formerly in the council cabinet, and he is a council member. So he's the mouthpiece for both of us, I guess, especially if we live in Westbury on Trim or Henlees. Now, we've mentioned a few of the reviews that the current administration at City Hall have undertaken. There's talk of a 20 mile an hour speed limit review. University of the West of England came out with research this week saying the introduction of the 20 mile an hour speed limits has saved 4.8 lives every year that it's been in place. Where do you stand on this? And does this review represent value for money that the council could probably do without spending?
Well, I was not convinced of the 20 mile an hour rollout across as many roads as it's come out. I think that there are a small number of arterial roads where I think it's confusing, and it certainly seems odd to me that it applies to motor cars but doesn't seem to apply to bicycles or buses, and therefore there are things I'm not totally convinced about. But on most residential roads, I can't actually see, and I think the report confirms this, that the average speed wasn't much above 20 miles an hour anyway, and it's reduced slightly. And to be honest, I cannot see that it's a problem, and I'm not quite clear why this review's been announced in the way it has, because if there was any significant changes needed, the council doesn't have the funding to implement it. And therefore, I would seriously question whether that is an appropriate review.
The number of people being caught doing more than 20 miles an hour in the 20 mile an hour zones has shot up in the last year. Is this a cash cow for Avon and Somerset Police, or is the council getting some of that kickback as well?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not aware the council's got a vast income stream from that, so I don't think so. I think that it's all about the message to those who speed. And I know that there are certain roads where the council would not bring in a 20 mile an hour limit because the average speed on the road was so high that they knew they could not reduce the speed, and they did not have the resources, and the police didn't have the resources to monitor it. So I don't think it's a cash cow as such. On our residential roads, I must admit, I don't have a problem with it being enforced. And to be honest, if that money is coming in, it's going into someone's budget who needs it to spend and deliver their services. So I'm relatively relaxed about that. But I think it's that question of who are we trying to please here? And if I talk with people who were very strongly against the 20 mile an hour originally, I think those views have softened and people actually recognise it doesn't make a significant difference, but it does improve safety.
One thing I think we may have divergent opinions on is council management spending, the appointment of high profile individuals who are pretty nameless, pretty faceless. They're the grey suits who actually enact things. Phil Carr being a notable exception. He's the face of the Metrobus project and very often has the temerity to come out and say, yes, it's an excellent idea. It's going to deliver on time and on budget. That's never going to happen. There was the high profile case of Anna Klonowski, of course, mm-hmm. who was in the job for less than 6 months and took off with an enormous golden goodbye. There are two issues here. You and I are both old enough to remember double entry bookkeeping. You know, the left-hand side of the page should tally with the right-hand side of the page. The HR department who is awarding these contracts with the golden handshakes in them. It's important to state at this point the role of chief executive of Bristol City Council has since been abolished. But there were three incumbents before Anna Klonowski left. They were all paid an enormous amount of money and none of them really did a very good job.
I'm not sure. I don't think we are going to disagree, actually. I mean, the first thing with Anna Klonowski is we don't know what she was paid to go. And that's perhaps the biggest problem. We don't know what she was paid to go. We do know she was paid for three quarters of the time she was employed by the City Council through a personal service company rather than through the payroll.
That's bad news. She might have a massive tax bill then.
Well, she might do, but not as massive as it would have been if she'd been paid through the payroll. So we know there are things there that are not what I would have expected them to be. But part of the challenge is members do not know. So we don't know, with all the restructuring that's going on, we do not know what deals have been made to create vacancies. We know that people are appointed to some are appointed permanently, some are appointed to interim jobs. Part of the very big problem is the corporate knowledge of the council has largely disappeared because there are very few officers that have been in place for more than a matter of months in many cases, but certainly more than a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I do firmly believe the council needs to pay fairly substantial salaries to get good people in place because there are real challenges. But I don't understand why we need to keep changing those people. And it does worry me that we are building up these costs and these packages. We are employing people on an interim basis. When the council employs on an interim basis, it doesn't have to pay in accordance with pay scale. It can be at rates determined by officers rather than rates determined by councillors. Mm-hmm. So we don't actually know what people are being paid when they're only temporarily filling a place.
Okay. Could I just say, as a council taxpayer, I'm seeing mediocre people being paid an awful lot of money and not even then doing the job properly.
I need to be very careful what I say about council officers. I believe most of them are doing the job to the best of their ability. I do think there has to be a question about what the market rates are and what we get for what we pay. And I have always believed we should have very clear rules of what we expect of staff. And if they don't deliver, then we should be exercising our normal rights in that case, not paying them to leave. Mm-hmm. The classic joke is the moderately good football manager who does a job and then gets paid to leave and goes on to the next one. And sadly, there are certainly, if one reads the stories in the press, there are council officers who do that.
If you don't mind me saying, Jeff Gollop, you come from a financial background, you're a trained accountant, you have been sitting in the cabinet for a number of years, and certainly since 2010. You are the elected representative. I can't walk into the council chamber and say justice for this. You're there. Why are you not holding these people to account?
It's a very good question, and I am asking those questions. But actually, the questions I've asked in public or in private, I am not getting answers to. And therefore, attempts to understand how many interim officers are being paid more than the chief executive who left I've not been answered. And there does not appear, well, there's a clear wish not to answer, which inevitably leads me to believe that therefore the answer is more than I would like it to be.
Interesting. Are you saying that there may be an issue with transparency and, dare I say it, veracity from the council management?
Yes. Well, there is clearly an issue with transparency because no members are aware of the rates that are being paid to temporary appointments as senior officer post. And there is a difficulty because when you're trying to get people in to fill a post for three or six months whilst you make a permanent appointment, people who are choosing to travel a distance to come and fill that role are going to be charging you a premium for doing so.
Interesting. We better leave that there because I'll start to get angry. Let's talk about homelessness in the city. It's very high profile. It's been very cold this winter. There have been a number of deaths. And there was the sob story of the shop in Cabot Circus installing a sprinkler system to discourage homeless people from using their canopy. We hear this every year. Why isn't Bristol better? Why aren't we improving?
I mean, homelessness is one of those things that I think any civilised person is going to consider is unacceptable. But if you look at it sanguinely, you do have a problem. No authority would want to be established as the best provider of support for homeless people. They wouldn't wish to, purely because that would mean that everybody who was homeless would be heading in their direction. So you have a very, very difficult problem. You have to deliver with care and compassion the support that you need to give, but without doing it in such a way that you make your city a destination for people to aim to come to. Mm-hmm. And that becomes very difficult, particularly at the coldest times of year when the pressure on those services is at its worst. The mayor has established a number of initiatives to try and help provide more care and support. It's never going to be enough, sadly. And I have, I find the way Bristol responds and deals with homelessness is a remarkable web of public sector and third sector organisations that provide a significant amount of support. But it's never going to be enough. Mm-hmm. Actually, the other issue is that we've got to find ways of supporting the causes of homelessness, which is the mental illness issues and some of the addiction issues, because most people who are homeless, there's been some trigger event that has caused them to be in that situation. They haven't got any wish to be there, but circumstances put them there. So actually, one's got to make sure that we have the mechanisms for support and bringing and enabling them to deal with that problem. Otherwise, if you're simply putting money or facilities available to deal with the homelessness isn't actually solving their issue. So there is a wide series of things that need to be done. The problem is with the financial pressures that are going on. The council itself has limited resources. The very biggest problem is that the ultimate responsibility for families that are homeless falls to the council. And those are then in the most expensive form of accommodation. So ultimately, the council's best interest is to find affordable accommodation for those that are homeless so that it's spending less of its resources on catering for them. So it goes full circle. Mm-hmm. And, as I say, Bristol's challenge, it can't be the best, but it's got to be doing sufficient to actually be dealing with those who are living in our community and suffering.
Two points I would make to you. It is a Conservative government which has enacted the changes to universal credit. A number of cases of homelessness can be attributed to that, and literally people falling through the cracks. And the minute you haven't got an address, it's very, very difficult to access services and welfare issues. The other one, I'm not sure, as a former city of sanctuary, we should be aspiring to be the least worst for homelessness.
No, we, you're right. We shouldn't be aiming to be the least worst. But my point is that there is a very delicate balance. And the I'm amazed that how quickly the word gets around. When some of the northern cities tightened up very much on the way they were treating the homeless, that encouraged a movement to southern cities that weren't as aggressive, if you like. So it's very difficult, because that is, you're right. It's wrong that in a civilized society we should be making those judgments, but we have limited resources, and so there is an awareness that when someone comes from an area and they live in that area and they are homeless, that area has a responsibility for them. It's very difficult. How far do you extend that responsibility to other cases, however worthy they are, if they come from outside your area? Very difficult. I would hate to be having to make the decision on that. The City of Sanctuary issue, I mean, I I'll be absolutely honest, the City of Sanctuary, I started off as being someone extremely sceptical about City of Sanctuary. I spoke against it in City Council meetings, but when I became Lord Mayor of Bristol, one of the first things I actually attended was the launch of the City of Sanctuary in Bristol. And that actually made me, I talked with people, I heard a lot of the explanations and the discussions, and actually I can see that the need for City of Sanctuary is an extremely powerful one. But I am of the view that what we need to do is be providing the same level of service for all. It shouldn't be that we're giving a better level of service to people who are seeking sanctuary, but we should actually be open and caring and supportive. And that, if you like, comes full circle to a lot of the financial issues. I still believe the council can be more efficient in the way it operates. You touched on senior management levels and the amount of money we're paying people to go, or to stay, whichever it is. One of the areas that's gone up in the City Council in the last year is the spending on public relations and communications. Why? Yeah, we've got a whole host of things that we should be using that money for, and that could be homeless, that could be libraries, that could be public toilets. I mean, the list is endless. So actually, we have still got to keep looking at how we make the organisation work better and not be as bureaucratic and administrative as we are. We've actually got to be directing things at frontline service.
You're listening to the Friday Politics on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in this week for Tony Gosling, and you have been listening to me chatting to Councillor Jeff Gollop, Conservative Councillor for the Westbury-on-Trim and Henley's Ward, at my gaff this afternoon, because there was an administrative flop. He was supposed to be here live in the studio at 6 o'clock. Schedule changes, not following up, bad admin. I'm partly to blame, of course, but fair play to Jeff. He made time available, and we had a bit of a ding-dong this afternoon. And now, Martin Summers joining me in the studio, old Labour economist and regular on the Politics Show. Quite a lot of ground covered in that section there. Not a lot of sympathy for homeless people to start off with.
Well, I think you mentioned the whole thing about universal credit. I mean, the fact is that since this Tory government came to power, the last one, there's been a massive increase in homelessness. And I think that's pretty certainly, to my mind, to do with the rules of universal credit, which was brought in by Ian Duncan Smith. And, of course, they're trying to roll it out around the country, but they can't because there's all sorts of problems with it. A fundamental problem with it is that private sector landlords will not rent people on universal credit because they run up arrears, because they have a six-week gap and all the rest of it. And this has been clear from the get-go, but Ian Duncan Smith said, no, but we've got to give all these people their money in one big lump so that they learn how to manage their own money. So there's a sort of social engineering nanny state aspect to this. We're going to make people be better by making them manage their own money. But of course, everybody involved in the sector was saying, well, hang on a minute, the people, the most vulnerable people, the people with mental health issues, addiction problems, what have you, they're not going to manage their money. And of course, the private sector landlords won't you know, won't have them on their books.
And it gets worse, because the minute you don't have an address, all services are pretty much denied you.
That's right. And, of course, this is all concentrated in urban areas, as you know. And, of course, if these people were to be... once people lose their addresses, they're unlikely to be registered to vote. And then because of the electoral system, it's actually relatively prosperous small towns around London that determine who wins elections. And people who've not got any money or anywhere to live in the inner city have no way of influencing things at all. They're completely outside the system.
Okay, so how do we effect a solution?
Well, I think the obvious...
Because this isn't a problem. Well, that's
I know you're Irish, but the whole thing, I wouldn't start from here, is what you say. I mean, why did we sell off our council housing stock at less than its value to existing tenants, and not only do that, but not build any more? Now, if you carry on doing that for 30 years, the poorest people will end up in the street. And that's what's happening. And it's absolutely predictable. We don't need to have to cudgel our brains about why this is happening. Poor people have been thrown to the wolves.
Okay, so thank you. You've reiterated what the problem is. How do we now fix that?
Well, the obvious thing to do is universal credit. It's just change the rules of it so that we will pay directly to landlords. And so the landlords are told, and people on DHSS payments before, they were paid directly to landlords. And you just got to change that.
Okay.
That's a simple thing.
Here's a mad idea. There's talk about national service being reintroduced, which is good and bad, I guess. We saw Carillion collapse a couple of weeks ago. Hundreds of apprentices, thousands of apprentices in actual fact, without the means to complete their training. How crazy an idea is it that we, you know, rebrand National Service into a kind of national house building apprenticeship scheme?
Well, I mean, it's obvious what the Labour front bench are planning to do if they come to power is to build lots of low-cost housing and to use it as a means of training people and stimulating the economy. It's a no-brainer, really. But of course, if you do that, house prices will have to come down. Yeah, and don't forget that the Tory party is based fundamentally on winning elections in first-past-the-post constituencies where people want their houses to go up. So think about help to buy. That's a straight subsidy to potential Tory voters on more than 40 grand a year, because most people, you know, affordable housing for poor people is just not that's completely different, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And everything in this country has become, over many years, over my lifetime, dominated by the property market and the people who benefit from the property market. Lots of free money from the government. All the people who bought their council houses at less than the cost, you know, in other words, at less than they were worth, were given hundreds of thousands of pounds each by the government. And these are exactly the same sort of people who go, oh, these homeless people, feckless, why should we subsidise them, blah, blah, blah. But in actual fact, you've just received, you know, they were bribed with our money.
Okay.
And that was wrong. It was wrong at the time. And it's created a mess that we're still trying to resolve all these years later.
So what about back to my amazing idea for social re-engineering, building social housing nationwide, with a nationwide national service type apprenticeship scheme, which will then give young neets and disinterested people under 25 a sense of ownership over their community, build cohesion, and actually put hard-earned cash in their pocket, not handouts?
Well, all right. I mean, national service is... I think you can separate the idea of building homes from national service.
Why? Why would you have to do that?
Well, I mean,
I'm not talking about...
I'm saying you could do it through having a national service structure, but you can build homes and create apprenticeships without having everybody do national service. I mean, national service, if it's going to mean anything, like when my dad did it in the 1950s, is that some wealthy people have to do it as well, even though they want
Everybody has to do it.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, the point about, if you were to provide that, and it wouldn't have to be military necessarily.
That's what I mean. It's a civic service.
Yeah, but it costs quite a lot of money, Billy.
Like the bank, you know, should we just give it to the banks? And
well, we've already given it to the banks. That's the problem.
Exactly.
And they've got it.
And award shoddy contracts for public projects to companies like Carillion and the rest of them, and then put dodgy cladding up on things.
There is an issue in the shadow cabinet at the moment about what's going to happen with big infrastructure projects. Because, of course, in some countries, like Cuba,
everything is built by the government. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody's employed directly or indirectly by the government. There's no contracting out or whatever. But in most Western countries, big infrastructure projects are not directly run by the government. They're usually contracted out to big private contractors like Carillion.
But they are carefully overseen by the government because yes. It's the government who's paying
Well, exactly.
For them.
And of course, we were talking earlier about competition and Jeff was talking about competition in contracting out. Certain things, there isn't any competition. If you're going to build something like HS2 or whatever, it's so massive that you can only have one big contractor who then carries it out of subcontracting to everybody else. So you get a whole line of subcontractors. And I suppose you could argue that the government should be ultimately the boss, and they could employ the subcontractors. Mm-hmm. And of course we could. I mean, there was a general bias in the way things were done in the 1940s and 1950s towards the government doing it, because the government was seen to be more efficient and more capable of doing what it, and we've forgotten all about that.
And there was hundreds of thousands of unemployed men and slightly disabled
men. Well,
they were all
being demobilised after the war, and
exactly.
So on. And there was a general attitude, well, we can, you know, can do. Now, what we need is that can-do attitude rather than what can we do, you know. We've sold off all... I mean, there were 13 years of Labour government, and they didn't do anything to allow local councils to...
They did less than nothing, Martin, because they introduced tuition fees and went into war twice.
Well, indeed, but we're just talking about housing. They didn't allow local authorities to build council houses. Why ever not? Oh, they said, well, that's history. We can't do that. And of course, eventually, we'll come back to doing sensible stuff, which was because it was sensible in the first place. Eventually, you think, well, hang on a minute. Why can't we? Well, we've given up on that now. We're modern. We don't do things like that anymore, like build council houses. That's so 1950s. It's like, well, yeah. You know, it's just stupid, isn't it?
Don't get me started. Actually, you've got me started now. I mentioned to Jeff in the piece, and this is something I'm very interested to hear your opinions on. I said, let's not talk about that too much because I'll get angry. I'm now angry anyway, so let's just flip and we'll talk about it. Yeah. Senior officers in the council, officers, these are council employees on huge salaries. They're not elected representatives. And according to Jeff Collop, they're not accountable to the elected representatives either. He particularly mentioned, I called him Phil Mann, which is incorrect. Phil Mann used to run the planning office. It's Phil Carr. No, okay. It's Phil Mann who does run the Metrobus and Transport. Phil Carr used to run the planning office. My apologies, both gentlemen. Here is an open invite for me to come to the BCFM studio to justify your salary. But all I've seen from both of them for years is incompetence, and they're not alone.
Well, I mean, I this question of whether the managers are up to the job, I find very difficult to get involved in because I don't know enough about it, to be honest with you. But I think it is bizarre that Karnofsky's payoff was found out about through leaks to Private Eye in London. I mean, you know, this starts to sound as if, you know, we don't know what's going on, and if we did know, we wouldn't like it. No, but I don't want to do... I mean, this, you know, this show tends to take a fairly robust oppositional stance to whoever is running Bristol, as it should. I am dismayed by the perceived lack of... you know, that nobody really knows what's going on at this level of the council, and I'm dismayed because I want to see the Labour mayor and the Labour council succeed, and you know, this sort of stuff doesn't, you know, help. But I don't know what to say about it because I don't understand all of the ins and outs of it. They've lost an awful lot of previously incumbent people. And there's been a lot of change going on, and you know, in any organisation, if you have lots of change at the top like that, you can end up with a quite chaotic setup, and that is worrying. But I mean, I'm very much an outsider on it, so I don't really have much to add.
Okay, yes, that's the kind of impotent rage I've been feeling all afternoon. It's the Friday Politics with Billy Quain and Martin Summers in the studio. Now, Martin, you've listened to the entirety of my chat with Jeff Gallop. What questions did I not ask him?
Well, I think what I would say is that the wider questions of government policy at national level, because he's a local politician, and of course local politicians have got to work within the context of what they got. You know, we've got to make X number of cuts, we've got to manage things, and inevitably the question then becomes, well, why have we got to do this? And of course, ultimately,
it's about the big questions that national government has to resolve. And Jeff is part of the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party are the government of the country with the Democratic Unionists, although they're not directly involved. perhaps we can come to that in a minute. They've got to take responsibility for the fact that that they're the ones who've decided that all this stuff's got to be cut. And as I said earlier, they've cut the top rate of tax. When Cameron was first elected, he said, "We're all in this together. It's going to be tough, but there's going to have to be sacrifices, but we're going to make sure that those sacrifices are evenly spread." But there's no case, to my mind, whatsoever for cutting taxes for the wealthiest people in the country in those circumstances. There's just no case for it, is there?
No, I'm completely with you on that one. Thank you. I tried several times to paint him into a corner about national policy, and he just wouldn't be drawn.
Well, that's because he's actually, as Tories go, he's one of the more thoughtful people. And I think it was interesting when he said when he was Lord Mayor and he got involved in the City of Sanctuary campaign. That's exactly what my experience of him. Once he'd met some asylum seekers and refugees, his view softened because he's a nice guy, and once he's exposed to that, he said, "I can see there's something that needs to be done here." But it wasn't natural to him because he's a Conservative.
Good. Well, let's give the Conservative his the last of his opinions and thoughts for the evening. I was kind of wrapping up at this stage, and it was any other business. I just thought I would make sure I tried to not leave any stone unturned with Jeff Gollop, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henlees. Jeff Gollop, you are Ward Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henlees in post until 2020, courtesy of the electoral changes which came in, I think, 2014 roundabouts, a little bit before the last mayoral election. Are you feeling secure in your post? And more importantly, are you thinking, yes, I'm quite looking forward to the next after 2020?
I'm in a very fortunate position, and I have I think I had the highest vote of any councillor in Bristol in the last election. That's partly because I've got one of the largest wards, so it's not. But I'd never feel secure. You are only ever in place as long as you have the confidence of your residents. And that can be down to something you do or something your political party does or doesn't do. So all I can do, in many ways, my politics have nothing to do with my day-to-day work as a councillor. I'm there to represent the people of my ward, whether they voted for me or not. And I will just do that as best I can, and I shall enjoy an election when it comes round. But I'd never make a prediction on what the outcome would be. That's in the hands of the electorate, and actually that's a very good way it should be, because it should mean you always remain that little bit dependent on the goodwill of the people you represent, and I'd far rather it was that way.
Are you likely to throw your hat into the mayoral election ring for 2020?
I can categorically say no. I loved doing that when I did it, but no, I've gone past that, and I simply want to represent the people in my ward.
Do you see a time in the next 20 years, because with these fixed-term councils, you're looking at five councils in 20 years, when the Conservatives have an overall majority in Bristol?
There's always that possibility. I mean, I'm sufficiently old that I can remember back to the time when the Conservatives had three MPs in the city of Bristol. So that could happen. It will only happen when a variety of circumstances in terms of national government and it can be what other parties do or don't do as well as what Conservatives do or don't do. All we do is to speak up for the people we represent and try and put forward an alternative to those who are running the council. And if at some stage over that period of time residents think that's appropriate for them to vote for, that would be fantastic. But because of the way the mayoral system works, you ideally need to both have a majority for the mayor and a majority in council. Now, Marvin has that at the moment. George Ferguson only had himself, and actually had to work to get the rest of council to approve his budget and his way of operating.
Where do you stand on Marvin's clearing out of the Rainbow Cabinet and filling it up with acolytes?
If he'd asked me, which he didn't, I would have said that the Rainbow Cabinet was actually a key to the message about how Bristol was run. One of the members he got rid of was my party colleague, and another was a Green councillor who I'd worked with in cabinet as well. Both of them superb members of the cabinet. So I think it's unfortunate to have parted company with members of the cabinet who actually were full time working as cabinet councillors, and replaced them with a full Labour slate. That's his prerogative. But the gesture of a cross-party cabinet was a really powerful one, and the removing of it, I think is a great pity, because our city is a rainbow city. It needs to be identifying that each party has a part. Some have good views on some things, some have good views on others, and some don't have. You know, the policies may be not worthy of agreement on certain things. That most politicians would find things within their own party that they're not going to agree with everything. But to me, giving up the Rainbow Cabinet is something that Marvin may come to regret.
Your group leader, Conservative group leader in Bristol City Council, has recently posited the idea of applying council tax to the 90,000 students who choose to come to Bristol to study. Where do you stand on this?
We're not advocating necessarily that the students should pay. We are saying that there should be some contribution to the council from the university for those residents, because we recognise the university is a fundamental part of the investment in the city and of what the city is. On the other hand, it is really galling to see buildings for 300, 400 university students not paying any contribution to council tax, when actually we also need those very buildings for key workers who can't afford to live close to their place of work. So we have students who are living in the centre of Bristol who use the clubs and pubs and waste facilities and everything else that's around the centre of Bristol, but aren't actually paying anything towards it. So what I think all members would like to see is some contribution from the university for those students, whether it comes through the companies that provide them with housing or from the university. We're actually not that fussed, but there needs to be some mechanism that recognises there needs to be some contribution without pushing them away. We don't want to lose them, but we do need them to contribute to what they actually cost.
Are the Lib Dems toast forever? And what next? I mean, are you happy? Are you optimistic for the future of Bristol?
I'd never say the Lib Dems are toast. They run on a basis of genuine community politics in the wards where they are represented. They have a strong presence and their residents think they're fantastic. So I would see that they will always have a future, not least as a protest party. Bear in mind, in Bristol, they were a protest party, first of all, for Conservatives who didn't want to be Conservative when the Conservatives were unpopular, then for Labour supporters who didn't want to support the Labour Party. What caused them real grief was when they came to power, because then they were no longer... They couldn't just oppose everything for the sake of it. They had to make some decisions. So I would never rule them out as a possibility somewhere. And that could change at any stage. And it's back to your question to me about my position. You never know, because you never know where that threat is going to come from. One of the interesting issues is the Lib Dem view on Europe, because I wanted to remain in the EU. I don't, however, know how you can demand a second referendum when you don't like the way the result went the first time round. And that's one where I'm not happy with trying to be all things to all people. But I, you know, you ask about the future for Bristol. I believe Bristol's future is very sound. Bristol's got where it is over many years, in spite of the City Council, not necessarily because of it. The council and the combined authority are genuinely trying to help develop the area and to grow. So with a little bit of guidance and assistance, I think Bristol will continue to prosper. But the impact on our economy of leaving the EU is a measure that, to be honest, I don't think there's any expert in the world who's actually worked out what that impact is. So I think that time will tell. But we are better placed than any city outside London to weather whatever storm that brings.
Well, on that positive note, Jeff Gollop, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
Well, he doesn't struggle for words much, old Jeff, does he?
No, he's quite fluent, isn't he? And I think it's quite interesting that he's a Remainer. I've always known that. But it puts him at odds with many of his Conservative colleagues, of course.
Anybody with any sense, in Bristol especially, should have been a Remainer. If you look, for instance, at the Airbus jobs up at Filton, you know, they're always talking about the highly paid aerospace jobs in North Bristol. Do you honestly think that Airbus, the management of Airbus, are now thinking, oh, do you know, tariffs to get those small pieces of the aircraft that we build in the UK... we should persist with that and enjoy how much more difficult our life has become. Surely not. 5 years' time, they'll be making all those parts on Europe.
Well, as you know, there was a fairly substantial Remain majority in Bristol itself. It's going to cause huge problems. We were talking about Northern Ireland earlier, and of course the DUP's position on whether they want a hard or a soft Brexit is going to be decisive. Because they hold the balance of power.
Yeah, the problem with the DUP is they don't know themselves because they're inherently thick. They're in post because it's a sectarian vote that's put them there.
Well, that's true. And I think a lot of people who voted to leave the European Union, if you were to ask them, should we remain in the single market before the vote, they would have said, what's the single market? Because that's the level at which the debate's been conducted. Mm-hmm. It's now becoming, the reality of it is starting to bite. And I think we're going to see a major political crisis over this in the near future. And it would have been interesting if Jeff was here, because we could have discussed the infighting in the Tory party about what's going to happen. Because they are now fighting pretty. I mean, this so-called war cabinet that they've created, warring with itself. Mm-hmm. It's deliberately designed by Theresa May to have a no majority for either staying, going for a soft Brexit or a hard Brexit, so that she can carry on pretending that she doesn't know whether she wants a soft or a hard Brexit.
And
of course, this is all going to come to a head.
It could lead to
the fall of the government. Of
it's a
could.
Race to the bottom. Well, I'm surprised it's still there, but frankly, there isn't a credible opposition, and nobody else is going to want to do the job.
Under the rules that were set up by the original coalition government, there isn't necessarily going to be an election if the government falls. What happens is that the Queen has to call Jeremy Corbyn to Buckingham Palace to decide to see if he can form a government. Now, if you got some Jeff Gollopite Conservatives working with the Liberal Democrats, Plaid Cymru, maybe the DUP may be split over a soft Brexit, hard Brexit. Yeah,
I'm not sure they have the intellectual heft to understand.
Well, I don't think there's much point, being snidey about it. They are. I mean, don't forget because of all the stuff that's gone on in Northern Ireland, there's a very very serious political leadership on both sides. They know about negotiations and brinkmanship and all the rest of it, and I think that they not. You see, if there is a hard Brexit, there's going to have to be a hard border.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they don't want a hard border. I mean, what happened when Theresa May went to Brussels and said, we can accept that Northern Ireland will remain, might have separate. It's perfectly sensible. Could have separate arrangements. So whatever else Britain wants to do, Northern Ireland can have separate arrangements. Now, that would be fine. And then that would actually facilitate a hard Brexit for England, because Ireland would be out of the equation. And it was agreed with the Irish government, with all the other EU27, and it's written into the agreement that there will be no hard border, and a failing agreement, Northern Ireland will effectively remain inside the customs union and the single market. But the DUP then said, we don't want to be outside Britain. Because what that would imply is there would have to be some kind of border control at Stranraer and Holyhead and so on.
Mm-hmm. And dare I say it, it's nudging them slightly closer to government from Dublin.
Well, it is. But nobody's suggesting that they're going to become part of the Irish Republic. It's a special magic land, which is not part of Ireland and not part of Britain.
Great. And cue the leprechaun jokes. Excellent. Now, look, we need to move away from Northern Ireland, because the Dutch and Vladimir Putin have been knocking lumps out of each other this
week.
Well,
I mean, Tony Gosling, who is our regular presenter.
And
founder of the show. He's picked up something that the Dutch foreign minister has had to admit this week, that he invented a load of things that he said he met Putin, and Putin told him this and that and the other, and he's been, you know, went on all the TV shows and everything a few years ago saying, and Putin wants to do this and Putin wants to do that. It turns out that he's never met him, and such conversations never occurred. And,
okay.
In other words, you know, the general. If we can talk for a little minute, a moment about Russian politics, and I'm a regular contributor on Russia Today here in Bristol. Last week, I had to contribute about because Russia Today books BBC studios here in Bristol for me and for other people, and also around the country. And the Times kicked off about this, Murdoch's Times kicked off about it, and some Tory minister kicked off about it. But anyway, that's a slight diversion, because what I wanted to talk about was the Russian presidential election. Now, Putin looked to be an absolute shoo-in, because he's actually terribly popular, which most people in the West just don't seem to get their heads around. He's got a hugely, you know, he's basically massively increased people's living standards and made the country feel as if it's a power in the world again, and that's popular.
And he's not afraid to get his shirt off for his birthday.
No, I mean, yes, he's perhaps not as ripped as our mayor, who I actually saw Billy Marvin turned up to electioneering when I last saw him over the summer, and he was wearing a Superman T-shirt. Would you believe?
Nice.
He looked pretty good in it, I have to say. And I think Putin probably looked pretty good in a Superman 2 shirt as well. But anyway, the fact is that this guy called Grudinin has been chosen to be the Communist Party candidate. And all the other candidates, like Navalny, that's been, you know, that's been disbarred, Ksenia Sobchak, who's in America this week, they've got minuscule opinion poll ratings. Zhirinovsky, who's the far right, he's got a substantial following.
Mm-hmm.
But Grudinin has, as soon as he came forward, he's well known in Russia. I'd never heard of him before. Opinion polls started to show that he was neck and neck with Putin. So in other words, what looks as if it might be a shoo-in for Putin in March, looking as if it's going to be a proper election in which the Communist Party might win. I'm not saying they will win, because Putin has got an awful lot going for him. Incumbency, you know, he's been doing the job for years, etc. But I think most commentators in the West don't seem to realise that the only people who've got a chance of removing him from power are the Communist Party.
Interesting. Perestroika hasn't really worked out that well, has it?
Well, it didn't. I mean, it was a disaster. I mean, Gorbachev is well remembered in the West as a kind of good, well-meaning chap. But in Russia, people are really hostile to him because he basically sold the country out.
Well, he's a traitor. Yeah.
Well, that's the sort of thing that Zhirinovsky says.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's true. I think the problem for Gorbachev was he was very naive about the kind of people he was dealing with in the West. He basically gave everything away on the assumption that the other side would reciprocate, and of course they not only didn't reciprocate. I mean, for example, he had an agreement that if he agreed to a unified Germany, NATO would not be expanded into the former communist countries.
Mm.
And of course, that's the NATO is now knocking at the door of Russia.
Well, indeed, which is what brings us to what brings Turkey to the table, and the Israeli jet being shot down over Syria this week.
Yeah, well, the situation in Syria is becoming incredibly dangerous because it looks as if the U.S. Air Force have killed quite a lot of Russian people who were fighting with the government forces. And it's being played down in Russia because these guys were not actually directly employed by the government. They were working for a Wagner, like a mercenary company.
Yeah, like Blackstone.
Like Blackstone or whatever. And Yavlinsky, who's a liberal candidate in the presidential election, is that he's trying to put pressure on Putin to say, who was killed and how many of them were there and blah, blah, blah. And Zakharova, who's the spokesperson for the foreign ministry, said, well, we don't really know because they're not directly employed by us. And they're trying to play it down because they don't really want to fight with the Americans for obvious reasons. The Russians have got enough kit in there to shoot down anybody that flies into the airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's Syrian army kit from Russia, which has took down this F-16. And, of course, it was probably US kit supplied via Turkey, which took down the Russian pilot the week before.
Uh-huh. So is this Israel sticking their nose in where it really shouldn't be?
Well, Israel is sticking its nose where it shouldn't be, but it's not just the Israelis. You've got, I understand, I was looking at the internet earlier, and the Russians have agreed with the YPG, which is the
Kurdish militants,
who always traditionally were helped by Syria in their fight against Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they have agreed to allow the us understand it. I don't know whether it's true. It's just rumor circulating this afternoon that the Syrian Arab Army will be allowed into Afrin to line up with the YPG to fight the Turks. Now, this is a problem because the same time the Russians are trying to make a rapprochement with the Turks, but they're put in a difficult position. They've got reasonably good relations with the Kurds, but of course the US military are embedded with the Kurds, and that's why they said they carried out this airstrike on Syrian army and Russian people this week, because they were saying that they attacked the YPG. But I think what they were trying to do, what the Russians were saying, is they were carrying out a reconnaissance mission because what they want is to get back the oil fields, which are under the control of YPG.
Ah, there we have it. It's the oil.
The oil fields. Yes, of course. This is what this is all about. Yep. So it's been all about all along is controlling resources and, the geopolitical struggles that are going on to dominate the planet.
OK, we're nearly out of time. When is the Russian election?
In March, I think it's March the 20th.
Oh, excellent. So we've got plenty of time to cover the blow-by-blow of what goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it was looking as if it was just going to be a straightforward Putin cruises to victory.
Mm-hmm.
But it may be that it's going to be more interesting than that.
Good.
Grudinin is the
Grudinin,
name of it.
Yes. Is he going to end up dead by March?
No.
Okay, and finally, very quickly, is the South Korean president doing the right thing, going to go and see Kim Jong-il?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they could easily do a deal there. The Russians and the Chinese could put railway trains in, which run straight through North Korea to South Korea, and then you could put everybody in North Korea to work, employed by South Korean companies.
Easy peasy. Problem solved. Thank you, everyone. Mohammed's up next with Leila Arabia. I hope we get some news. Good night.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol. Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.